Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speakers today are Nick Schweitzer and Pat Bober. And they're both members of First Unitarian Society, and Nick is also a member of the Free Congregation of Sauk County. Welcome and thank you for putting your program on the evolving brains, emerging gods, early humans, and the origins of religion.
So this started when Bob sent out a message saying, does anyone want to review this book? And it interesting enough to, I think, both Pat and me that we said, yes, we'd like to read it, and willing to present all of our great wisdom from the reading. I'll start, and Pat is much more expert on certain areas that he discusses, all the brain functions, etc. But I will try to give a little background. The title, again, Evolving Brains, Emerging Gods. And the underlying assumption of the book is that gods come from the human brain. I have a feeling I'm in safe territory with this group stating that.
You mean you're not going to get struck by a thunderbolt?
Well, you know, if I do, we'll have to rethink. But the specific argument of the book is that the gods arrived only after the brain, the hominid brain, had developed certain cognitive developments, and I'll go through those. You've got illustration of just the hominids that we talk about, and on the back are some of the points that I'm going to make here. The author says that humans went through a developmental stage where first they simply had more intelligence than the people around them, people, animals. Second, they developed self-awareness. Third, what these is called theory of mind, and I've never been quite comfortable with that phrase, but it means being able to think of what other people are thinking, theory of mind. Fourth is introspection, thinking about your own life. And fifth is autobiographical memory, which is being able to put yourself in context of past and present and be able to predict the future. So the author posits that these developed over millions of years and is going to put them in their categories. Now, the author, which is on the back, E. Fuller Torrey, is not an archaeologist, he's not an anthropologist, he's not a brain scientist, he is a psychiatrist. He knows a lot about people with schizophrenia. So he's a well-educated person. But reading the book, I think we both agreed, he comes across as a bit of a dabbler in all of these other fields and is pulling ideas in that he doesn't perhaps know in great depth. However, the book makes sense. It doesn't not make sense. And I think it is very thought-provoking. I hope you'll have some comments about it. So he understands a lot about the brain and its function today. Some of his arguments are based on the paleontological record and the size of the human skull. And he makes certain assumptions, or at least inferences, from the size and the shape of the human brain and the skull, which may or may not be true. He also relies on the development of human infants. Once in a while he'll say, well, at age 2 they can do this, but by age 4 they can do this, and he says that may recapitulate what evolved in the past. That also can be a little questionable, but again, it raises some good questions. And then occasionally he'll compare modern day humans with modern day primates, some of the primate research that goes on, and say, humans can do this, primates can't do that, there's obviously a difference in brain function, and maybe even look at the brains of them. So, I'm going to go as far as the five categories of people that he talks about. All right.
Okay, which are up there.
Yeah. And on the pictures. There are only four here, but he separates Homo sapiens early and Homo sapiens later. So, he starts by simply saying that mammals, when they filled the niches left by dinosaurs, ended up having larger brains than reptiles, which pretty accepted fact. And let me give you a little digression here, which has nothing to do with our presentation this morning. There's science expeditions going on in the Discovery Center this weekend. This is one of the UW's major outreach to the community, science, inviting kids to come in and see things. And on the floor of the Discovery Center, that building near Union South, I have installed 18 stages of from the formation of the earth through single-celled animals, multi-celled animals, fish, reptiles, birds, dinosaurs, humans, etc., along about a 500-foot length on the floor. And you can go see it.
Cool.
They even said they're going to keep it beyond this weekend because they'd rather like it.
Where's the building again?
It's the Institutes Boston for Discovery.
Oh, okay.
I call it the Discovery Center.
Yeah,
so
all right.
I'm being sloppy. But I was. So mammals fill the niches filled by vacated by reptiles and dinosaurs in particular, as you know. The mammalian brain is particularly different in what they call the forebrain, and it's at that point that I almost turn it over to Pat, because what is a forebrain?
you'll find out.
She'll be talking about that. But that increased not just the brain increased not just in volume, but the forebrain in particular increased disproportionately to the rest and the old brain. And then saying that humans, as they developed out of the basic primates, also developed a brain that is disproportionately large in comparison to its body size to other animals, not just mammals. So the argument goes through five stages, and they're listed across here, and four of them are there. But Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Homo sapiens, archaic, which he also refers to as the Neanderthals.
Right.
Right. And then modern human, early Homo sapiens and modern Homo sapiens. And do you want to say anything before I go through this whole litany of what each of those groups did?
No, I don't think so. I think we're on the same track.
All right.
Here.
Here we go. Homo habilis is the first Homo species out of the Australopithecines. They're tool makers. And in fact, they're basically almost defined by being tool makers. And the author interprets that as being more intelligent than other primates. So intelligence is step one in the development of the human brain. It had a large brain, 630 cubic centimeters, compared to the Australopithecines, 400 cc's. And he makes a statement that the skulls of Homo habilis suggest that the increase was mostly in the frontal and parietal lobes, which would be the thinking, rational thought. Pat and I have co-taught a couple of things, and she always knows about the brain, and I know about a few other things.
But that is what he asserts.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The next step, Homo erectus, actually, I've got these in different order. Homo habilis, 2 million. Yeah, you've got the time reversed on those.
Oh, I switched them. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. Once again, Homo erectus had a larger brain, up to 1,000 cc's. And the author claims that at this point, humans, let me start calling them that, or humanoids, or hominins, developed self-awareness. And actually, this is a very weak part of his statement, because he doesn't give much evidence for that. Self-awareness is being able to recognize who this is in the mirror, or in the surface of the pond. There's no evidence of it. He just sort of thinks it happened. It certainly happened by the next stage. And Homo erectus is the species of Homo that left Africa and populated basically all of the East whatever, from Africa to into Europe and as far as Indonesia. So the statement is self-awareness. The archaic Homo sapiens, which is Neanderthals, are the ones that we see burying people. There are burials. So he gives that the quality of theory of mind, that people can think about what other people feel and think, an awareness of other people. There was also evidence not only of burials, but of some very aged individuals who had severe injuries and were probably cared for by the community. So it's caring for other people. Turns out that their brain capacity is not only larger than Homo erectus, but it's even larger than ours. 1,480 cc's, where ours is closer to 1,350 as an average. Okay, beyond theory of mind, beyond being able to think of what other people do, then the early Homo sapiens, which he puts at 100,000 years ago, is capable of self-reflection, introspection, thinking about oneself, and that is evidenced, according to him, by showing self-decoration, necklaces, earrings, ochre, used probably to color their own bodies. So more thoughts about themselves. And then the modern Homo sapiens, which he, the break is at the agricultural revolution about 40,000 years ago, is when he talks about autobiographical memory, not only being able to see yourself as a person, but seeing yourself in the past. You have memories of the past, which you can work from to think about the future, as well as an understanding of death. He thinks that comes in along about this time. And the first recorded version of this story is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is all about death. I don't know if any of you know it, but it's the hero Gilgamesh goes off to try and figure out how to avoid death. It's a very long poem, and in the end, it's, the conclusion is you can't. You can't avoid death. But it's an overwhelming concern at that time. And the author states that gods and religions provided solutions to the problem of death, something I certainly agree to. I think that's a very strong part of it. There are a few other details I have, but I think it'd be good for you to talk about how much support there is in the...
Okay. One comment I would make about modern Homo sapiens is that they go back 40,000 years, but the agricultural revolution only goes back about 12,000 years. So that's part of the modern Homo sapiens. And we'll talk about how later about how that affects how we feel about the book. But so some of the major concepts that he promotes in this book, as Nick said, that evolutionary changes in the brain enabled new cognitive processes in humans. Okay, so that's kind of his main point. But he's got some other major themes that come out, and one is that death awareness and the ensuing anxiety from death awareness is a major factor in the emergence of worship. Okay, dreaming is a major factor in the development of the belief in an afterlife. He talks a great deal about, you know, research into dreaming or assumptions about how dreaming made people feel like they were perhaps visiting another world or others were visiting them. As Nick said, he asserts that childhood brain development in modern humans is a parallel to evolution. The old ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That's a, you know, kind of an old theme that the evolution must parallel the way children develop. That climate change promoted group living, and that large group living and new cognitive processes resulted in religion. So as you look at the chart, and my apologies for switching those first two, I had my glue stick out and I guess I put them in the wrong place. But This is one of the charts that's in the book, other than the names of the different species and subspecies. But then he asserts that that brain development resulted on one side in the kind of social developments of the agricultural revolution, the population increase, the settling in towns of cities, and the development of kings and authority. And then in terms of religion or worship, it resulted in those other factors: awareness of death, afterlife, ancestor worship, hierarchy of ancestors, gods emerge and gods assign secular tasks. And I think Nick will probably talk a little bit more about that later, which he says resulted in religions and some of the other behaviors that we find in religions. So in relation to the brain, I got another handout, and I hope I didn't get too crazy about this for you. It gets complicated.
Speaking of your brain, mine just sort of shuts down when I look at something like this.
I'll leave one for Mary, and I'm sure Dr. John and Dr. Mary can help me out with this a little bit and correct me where I'm wrong.
Stay very long.
So what I have done here, look at the slide that has just one picture on it. All I've done here is highlight the areas that he talks about. And this is an additive exercise for him, so that anything, like he talks about Homo habilis, the first species he talks about, have the yellow areas developed, okay? And that, as Nick said, that's the forebrain, the part in the front, and then part of the parietal lobe. So this is, what you're looking at is the brain from the outside, the cortex, you probably all learned, you know, that at some point in time, with the different lobes, and then the red being the cerebellum. So for Homo habilis, he says these yellow parts developed, and then Homo erectus added a part that you can't see on this side, you can see it on the other side, which is that little green space in there, okay? And you can also see on this other side, from as if you cut the brain from the top going through, which would be a coronal, they call it a coronal section. And then the second one on the two picture one is if you cut it from front to back right through the midline, okay? So then for the archaic Homo sapiens, the Neanderthal, you see the blue areas that he claims developed. And then for early Homo sapiens, he adds the purple areas. And modern Homo sapiens, he adds the red or orangey areas. So you can see he's not talking about a lot. I mean, there's a lot of the brain he's not talking about. He's mainly talking about cortical areas. He doesn't talk much about the deep areas. And surprisingly, and he uses the word surprisingly, the ones that he says come into play in modern Homo sapiens are some of the most ancient parts of the brain. Okay, parts that actually reptiles have, the cerebellum.
Well, I think he makes quite a issue about the connection, because it's the connections that create the complex brain and the complex function.
Yeah, and that was part of my my questions about this, because he really does present a lot of the cortex, and I think a person could be very confused by thinking, you know.
Oversimplified.
Yeah. So he does say how human behavior changed so dramatically over the past 100,000 years, the answer is to be found in the white matter tracts of brain areas as they become increasingly interconnected. And so, you know, we have to consider, is that really part of evolution? Is that part of adaptation? You know, as cultures go along and pass, because you're constantly remodeling the white matter in your brain. Every time you learn something, you're changing the structure of your brain. So I won't name these parts for you unless you have questions about these, but...
This is a test. Give me the E prime. How much evidence is there for any of this?
Well, that's what we're going to get into next, is the critiques. Because, as Nick was saying, he relies on three areas of study in which evidence is incomplete and still developing, and it leads to wide speculation. Archaeology, neurology, and religion, all of which, you know, there's wide speculation. So I think his hypothesis is logical, but it's very speculative, and the books is full of must have, could have, may have, you know. One of the problems with the archaeology of the hominins, the hominids and hominins,
not hominins,
now they use as a term for anything that's human. Hominids include other primates. But to me, the way he talks about it is like it's a continuous development. And if you look at any of the modern aging placing it on a timeline, you see that they're all separate. One doesn't necessarily lead to the other. So
some of them were coexisting, I believe.
Many were coexisting. Now we're finding out that people of European descent have Neanderthal DNA in them.
So there is, what you're saying is, you know, there's sort of jumps. Is that kind of what you're saying? It's not a continuum of slowly getting bigger. It's just sort of, you see a big jump.
If
you place them all on a timeline, there would be some at the same time and some at different times. It's not the progression that you see, you know, in the picture of the ape moving to erect and, you know, all the way up to human, modern humans. So that is, there are several examples of continuity where it's more likely there's discontinuity. And so that's true of the archaeology. It's true of the tool use. My daughter-in-law is a professional archaeologist and my husband is an amateur. And they have both noted that tool use would get very, 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 very good, very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Sophisticated.
Skilled, yeah.
And then it would drop. And then, you know, then you'd see your very crude tools again. So,
you guys have to go?
I'm sorry, we have to go. We have our driver. Our driver, I mean, you're the driver.
Thank you. It's so nice to see you.
I'm so glad to see you again. We both read the book.
You both read the book.
And enjoyed it, but I was pretty skeptical.
Yeah.
Many
times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this up, you know, up, and that's true also of child development. Children don't develop linearly. They go up and then they lose it, and then they go up a little higher and then they lose it. And so the implication that things are smooth bothered me a little bit.
I'm going to have three questions, and if I don't get them all in right now, then I'll come back to subsequent ones. But the first one is basically, is this science or is it speculation? Let me give a little background. There's a cartoon that I saw yesterday that said, the reason I keep eating meat is that it's too hard to explain why I'm not. So, do people stay in religion because it's too hard to explain why they're an atheist? In many instances, I think that's partially true. But the real question is this science or is it speculation? Which would you say it is? Be both, wouldn't it?
He has an extensive bibliography and notes. He has read a great deal. He has taken a lot of science, but then I think he's layering speculation on top of it, which we tend to do in our society. You know, I mean, look at the brain self-help books out there. You know, you do this and you'll change this.
Right. And I ask that because to me there's no science that proves that God exists, and so why believe it? Okay, second question.
Comment on that one. In reading this, it was my feeling that he probably knows he's skating on thin ice at times, but he really wants to get this idea out there, and I'm glad he did.
Yeah,
I mean, I think
well,
it's
now we're going to go to that. And the first part of what you were saying, Nick, is that brain size has a large impact on this, and so let's look at the list that you provided of the five areas. How far up the list does a dog go? How far up the list does an elephant go? And how far up the list, down the list, does a great blue whale, which is the largest whale,
mm-hmm.
the gray or the blue or whichever,
yeah.
But, you know, because I think that that's getting a smaller than humans and two examples of much larger than humans. Do those animals evidence any of these?
What they've generally seen, as far as I know, and I'm like a even worse than an amateur radiologist, but it's a sort of a relation to the animal size and the
yeah.
brain size. So if you look at this, it's kind of a continuum, and you'll have black crows that are a little bit higher than this line, and humans are a little higher than this line.
But even though elephants and great blue whales probably do have larger brains
yeah,
than
yeah.
we do, in relative to their size.
And those are very intelligent animals. They're thought to have.
I understand that.
Yeah, they're thought to have a
yeah.
lot of characteristics
and,
that share. But again,
yeah,
ratio.
Does a great blue remember where it's been and have a?
Does it worry about death?
Well, how would we know?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, if you look at with avian species and you look at the migration patterns. How they know where to migrate, where their kind have migrated for generations.
Mm-hmm.
You could take an animal that's never migrated before and it
yeah.
knows where to go. Look at the monarchs. I mean, there are some innate things that are pretty hard to explain
mm-hmm.
that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying, not just brain size, but connectedness, which to me means the chemicals that float between the different parts of the brain.
Yeah, brain size and you know, structure,
right.
I mean, like reptiles have a cerebellum, but they don't have all of the cortex like we have.
Monarchs don't have very big brains.
Right.
And not just the chemical connections, but literally
the wiring.
Neuronal connections.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the statements, I didn't make it, but is early on the mammalian, just mammals, developed six layers of neurons, whereas previously there were only three layers of neurons. I have no idea if that's true.
Yeah,
but
it
I mean
is.
That
we
increases the possibility for neuronal interconnectedness immensely.
So some of the
I think the big thing it does is the capacity.
Yeah.
Not all of us use it as
well. Well, you know, I've read that's kind of a myth. We use a lot more of our brain than we have been told that we use. It's,
some of us,
you know,
more than others.
What
did
you say?
So some of the problems with the neuroscience that he has on here is that he relies on skull formations to identify areas of growth in the cortex and connects it with types of cognitive development. And, you know, you might be able to do that with the frontal part of the brain because he can see that some of the brains are really flat in the front.
Yeah.
But as you see on your handout, a lot of it is enfolded inside or, you know, already inside, and how could you tell that from a skull formation?
Right. He does make the comment that brain development can be two ways. One, the brain can simply grow or create new structures. The other is repurpose.
Right.
Existing things. I gather you're saying something like that with the cerebellum. But, and you'll never see that. I mean, the fact that now this part of the brain is doing something different from what it did before.
Yeah.
And I wanted to add, this is not in what we talked of before, but human beings, modern Homo sapiens, did not know about the brain and what it does until 1650. You know, the Greeks thought it was a sponge that cooled the rest of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the church came along, and the church and the government did not let people desecrate the body. They you know, you were imprisoned or whatever for doing a dissection on a human body because that was sacrilegious. And so it wasn't until in England around 1650 that they started to really understand that the brain was really controlling the body. It wasn't the heart, you know, that it was. So we have to realize that we didn't have brains to look at before that time, and we certainly don't have their brains to look at. So comparing them with animals can be helpful, but it's not the end be all end all.
Right.
Nor is skull formation, nor is child development, because it's kind of a different ball of wax. And as I said,
if there is brain injury, I mean, the same injury can occur to three people, but the recovery from those injuries and the capacity for learning and changing can be totally, some people can make mm-hmm. phenomenal changes from major loss of brain tissue,
yeah.
and people can come through, and other people can fall on a sidewalk and bump their head and lose their memory that they ever, their whole
right.
memory for the rest of their life, and you're like, that's to me is puzzling what, you know, what ultimately controls how the brain functions and continues to function, because there's such a disparity in recovery
yeah.
after injury.
Yeah, and a lot of what we knew early on about the brain did come from injuries, that, you know, they could correlate
right.
how the person was behaving with what part was injured. And it's really only since the 1990s that we had brain scans
mm-hmm.
To the extent that we have now, where we can pair it up with an activity. So, a lot of speculation.
My asthma causes cholera.
My asthma, not my asthma, but M-I-A-S-M-A.
Yeah.
We mm-hmm. have learned a few things. So
well,
kind in of fact, in the beginning stages of understanding.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And I think if I were to start over again, I would love to go into neuroanatomy, neuroimaging. I mean, that was just such a fascinating field, and it's going to develop so fast. Continue to.
But it's still of the areas, it's one of the areas that's still fraught with non-understanding.
Oh,
sure.
sure.
It's just, which I think leads many people down the pathway of looking up here, the whole religious aspect, because it seems like there has to be somebody somewhere who's calling the shots and knows how these things work. Because, I mean, I think that's what people have a tendency to, when something is so complex and you don't understand it, there has to be somebody somewhere who...
Okay.
Right, an answer.
Yeah.
Do you
have
someone
who created
no.
it?
It's too complex for us to understand, so it has to be a God.
Go ahead.
So there are good reasons to read this book. I mean, he does a really good job of summarizing, you know, archaeology and excellent job of summarizing religious development, although I do love this book of Karen Armstrong's much more, if you haven't read it. She has a phenomenal understanding of the religions in the world and from the early development. Fields of Blood, Religion and the History of Violence.
So people think that there is a progression in religions then? That like older religions were more primitive than current religions? Or?
I can't speak to that. I'm not. It's not a concept that I have run across.
The answer is
okay.
God,
okay.
The answer is God knows.
God knows.
Well,
okay, I guess I heard.
They think religions have influenced each other, you know, as
right.
as people came... came in contact with each other.
In terms
other.
Of development or evolution to higher levels, I don't think so. I don't
oh,
no
I,
one's ever said that.
I
it's
okay,
just
okay.
here's one, here's another.
Okay.
Here's
yes.
another.
Yeah.
And some pretty stable over time, if you look at particularly, for example, some of the Native American and other Native cultures, they've had the same religious thoughts, pattern celebrations for a long, long time, and they're still holding forth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The author did happen to mention, it's completely tangential, but what is called the Axial Age. It reminded me of that phrase, which I haven't used for a long time. It's when many of the great religions were created. So between 2800 and 2200 years ago, that's 800 to 200 BCE, Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, Zoroastrianism, Taoism, and Judaism all developed.
Yeah. Elaine Pagels is very interested in that too. Yeah. And some people just dismiss it, so.
Was there a Johnny Appleseed?
Who sprouted those things?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sort of similarly, the author makes the point that at certain stages in human history, recent enough for us to be aware of them, like the development of agriculture, all of a sudden, all across the world, human populations were doing the same thing. As if perhaps there was a quality of mind that had evolved and allowed people to do certain things. Agriculture was independently developed on different continents, as were writing, pottery, embalming, astronomy, earrings, and coinage. And across all continents, you know, those happened within a few thousand years of each other. So it makes one think that there might be something going on internally.
And conversely, we have to understand that there was major climate change at that time. You know, at the time of agriculture, the ice age was ending. You know, the ice ages were ending. And
yeah, I haven't correlated those ideas.
Yeah, the world was warming. It was, you know, it was possible to notice that a seed made a plant and then to do something intently about it. So, who knows?
Passing information on through multiple generations doesn't appear to be on this list. Where does that fit in?
He doesn't mention it. I'd have to give it some thought. I mean, I don't have an immediate answer to that. Mm-hmm. That's certainly oral communication, which preceded written communication.
Right.
So we're talking about, almost certainly talking about the development of language, I would think.
And demonstration, you know, learning to do things from your parents.
You eat this mushroom, you don't eat this one.
Right, right. Your brother died.
Yeah.
Probably tied with the autobiographical.
Awareness.
Because this is something I discovered.
Of self.
That you need to know.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Good question.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
Doesn't come up in this book
and there,
at all.
There's another whole area that he doesn't bring up, which is epigenetics. And, you know, maybe that when
what
he wrote this.
What is epigenetics?
your DNA, your genes are passed down.
Mm-hmm.
But it appears that there's something, I don't know if it's a protein, I don't know it well enough, but that can wrap around the gene and also be passed down.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been finding that with certain behaviors like mothering in animals, that poor mothers tend to beget poor mothers, and it's not just learning.
Mm-hmm.
There was an instance that I remember being described where a grandfather was malnourished before the age of 10, before his sperm developed, and his grandson had diabetes, and they were able to link that through epigenetics. So that's another fascinating area to look at, how things develop. But that's not mentioned in here at all.
No, at all. And it reminds me of the word Lamarckism, which
Lamarckian, yeah.
Which is that you can, evolution isn't just this DNA over thousands of years. You can induce this in this generation, and it will be passed on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is mostly discredited, but maybe it's coming back now. I don't know. Fascinating stuff.
Well, I heard last night that President Trump doesn't have the gene for humility. On a democracy now.
How about intelligence?
Well, it seems like, you know, there's a huge amount of speculation, you know, that we're just starting to understand the brain. And because of that, there's a huge amount of speculation about
wide range of
ideas.
Speculation.
And,
mm-hmm.
I guess I'm a natural skeptic with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Why would that be?
Passed down through my genes.
Sounds like the author does have a point, because, I mean, why on earth would somebody invent religion? Unless they had some of these motivations.
There's one connecting thing that we didn't mention. He talks about ancestor worship. I mean, it comes up once or twice. And it may be starting with burials and caring for your own families, and then worshiping the past, the person who passed, who may visit you in a dream or something. And the ancestor, your great-grandfather or something, becomes more and more like a god. I mean, that's a slight way of connecting some things, how it, you know, how it started.
And it really started after people settled down, because he talks about how when they were nomadic, they had to bury somebody where they died because, you know, they didn't have a place to keep them.
Yeah, but as you become domesticated, mm-hmm. you want to get rid of the smell.
Right.
So,
or you
so
miss
really,
that person,
I mean,
and you want to keep their sense around.
I think that let's dump dirt on it to cover the smell up.
Right, but at least you can go back and visit the grave still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
and
origins
still
of the burials.
Yeah.
And then,
oh.
Well, I mean, that's where
right.
Dad is.
There was one example where they would build the house right over the burial. They would do the burial and then build the house. And there was one example where they kept the face up through the floor and covered it with concrete or, you know, some kind of mortar, so they could still see the face there. So, and you know, possibly, and you know, then he goes into speculation so that they could consult with him and, you know, all this. But so who knows? And you know, as far as the chart goes, I was looking at the way his chart is, have the lines run, but really those blue rectangles all go to modern Homo sapiens. None of that happened until 12,000 years ago. So it's really, really connected to things that happened within that period.
I think right now it's interesting. It's sort of, I guess there's a dichotomy because there's, in general, people aren't staying geographically with their quote-unquote families. I mean, I don't have a living, I'm living or dead, I mean, I have no connection to Wisconsin, but I live in Wisconsin. But I think that's pretty common now that,
uh-huh.
I mean, my ancestors are buried off in New England. And I think over time, cemeteries, which used to be a great source of figuring things out, aren't as significant anymore. People aren't doing burials. People are finding other ways to deal with bodies. And along with that, in the other direction, is people are becoming very super interested in ancestry. They're doing all this ancestry.com and figuring out where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of living apart from their families and living apart from their historical roots, so to speak. But yet at the same time, they're using ancestry and these other sources to search back to figure out where they came from. So I find that kind of interesting, particularly in the, whatever you want to call my millennials or younger people, that they're wanting to know the links in the ancestry. And is that because they, in fact, aren't connected to the
family? Well, I think that sort of brings up my basic thing, one of my basic things, is that there's these changes. And you could, if you were an archaeologist and you were looking into this, you could see these changes. And yet, to say that we're more advanced than we were in the 1800s seems,
it's how you define advanced.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if my brain is that much different or bigger, or my skull is a different shape than my ancestors from the 18 or 1700s. You know,
how big was your brain?
Well, and then we get into cultural evolution, which is very different.
Yeah, but I think some of that's what you do when you're looking at some of these sites. You know, you have cultural changes, and you're saying, you know, oh, we're burying people, and now we're not burying people.
I was saying to my daughter this morning that my grandchildren are going to have a big area of their brain that has thumbs, where compared to my grandfather, who probably could, you know, had log rolling or something.
If you look at the history of math or science with the great historic developers of all these fields of math and science, who did not have computers and calculators and all those things, yet they made grandiose strides compared to now. If you say, are we really improved? It would depend on electronics to help us do the same thing, but I don't think thinking-wise we're any more developed.
Well, one could say that the process of creativity, which is brain, the brain putting things together that weren't there before, may be hindered by computers. Who knows? I mean, we're not doing as much internal thinking. That's just a response to that.
Simply because I got tired of that sort of talk, Steven Pinker, the psychologist from Harvard, has a new book where he basically charts everything out and says, yeah, we are actually happier and more content than we were 50 to 100 years ago, and healthier and stuff like that.
Oh, good.
So
happier, but maybe not smarter.
John Hawks, I think, is one of those who's pointed out that the human brain size is shrinking in recent years, and it may be that we don't need to use parts that we needed for survival now that we've got modern technology to do so much for us.
The 7-Eleven.
What?
Able to buy everything, don't have to make things anymore.
Don't have to go hunting, we're not threatened in our survival. Food stores are in the grocery store.
So we'll see what the next climate change
does. Now, if we could just get rid of a few other things in a brain, like violence and anger and...
Yeah, I heard something a while ago about how, you don't believe everything you read, but how Neanderthals were much more social and less violent.
I've heard that, or read that theory.
And the Neanderthal brain was bigger, you know, something like that. So,
which is why they were... exterminated.
Right, right. More competitive.
Right. Unfortunate.
Yeah.
Does the author refer to current neuroscience in some of his sources?
Yes. Yeah, he does. Particularly brain imaging, you know, and what behaviors correlate with what areas of the brain.
So I'm hoping you can prep up the book that you really recommend, so I can write down the title.
Karen Armstrong.
Of this one?
That's one you say is better.
This one is if you are interested in the development of religions general. Right. It depends on what you're interested in. Now, I don't think I can tell you a contemporary book about archaeology.
Okay. When you say the development of religion, to me that sort of says there's sort of a progression of religion. Is that kind of what you mean?
No, it's more of a, she goes into every area of the world and talks about the different religions that came to be over time. I guess that's what I mean by development.
Yeah, I think the word development is not an evolutionary change, it's just here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things I've always thought is that religions that, if the religion doesn't teach to be nice and supportive of other people, if it's sort of harsh, you know, like everyone should worship me, that there's not much motivation to have that continue on.
No.
Yeah?
No, it depends. I mean, there's a self-deception of the brain. You have several examples, particularly with the apocalyptic religions, where they say, what's going to end here? And we're going to end here. But they still believe in the guy who says the world's going to end here, so they think that, you know, they managed to save it for another week or two. So they don't say this guy's a total poop, but they sort of switch their brains around to say, oh, we did some good work. We're going on.
Okay.
So,
you've got good points.
That doesn't really stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, spoiler alert on this book, her conclusion is that it was not the religions that fomented the violence. It was the leaders who used the religions to support violence.
Yeah.
But something in the religion allowed them to do that. That is the acceptance of higher authority.
Right.
And
yeah. And they could twist things around a little bit, too.
Sure.
I mean, you see that in just among Christian religions, you know, that the differences in the way that they're approached.
Uh-huh. Isn't there like some Christian religion where everyone's sort of born into different castes almost?
Predestination.
Right.
Certain number are saved and certain number are not, that kind
or
of thing.
Or that if you're wealthy and successful, that's because God is, you know.
That's a relatively new.
Yeah.
Which one of
them? There are different interpretations of religion. I think that's what
is that Calvinism? Is that, I mean, if you're successful, it's a sign of God's grace.
Yes.
There is.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
I think that's strongly believed in our current culture.
And it's even some.
They actually, I mean, the people who believe it now, they actually sort of built it up in the 50s.
Yep.
And 60s, but now they believe it, so.
Was there a particular area in your question of what you wanted to look at further? Because
well, like I said, Hinduism, where you're sort of reincarnated into a better self, and so if I'm wealthy, then that means I'm a higher evolution religiously than you are, or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But your question about what book would we recommend? Was it?
Well, if this is a religious one, then I'm not.
Oh, what part of what we talked about? Because I might be able to come up with
evolution
that.
Of the brain and how people think.
Well,
evolved,
I'm very partial
socially.
to DiMaggio, Antonio DiMaggio, and I think probably his most understandable book is The Feeling of What Happens.
And
he talks about
happened.
How the brain works and how. It's not all conscious and cognitive, but it's kind of the brain within the whole body responding to the environment.
Mm-hmm. So the feeling.
The feeling of what happens.
The feeling of what happens.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And if you're interested in the history of the discovery of the brain, Soul Made Flesh is a really good book, and that's not technical at all, but it tells kind of how this all came about.
That's England in the 1600s? Is that?
Yeah, that's from Soul Made Flesh by Carl Zimmer.
Mm-hmm. You might find some books in our library.
Yeah, right
in the next door over there.
I saw you had the Wathi book listed on your bibliography. I really enjoyed that one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, where he talks about someone will come. You know, being that the child has this feeling of when they cry that someone will come and help them, and he kind of expands that into the feeling of God will save me.
Hmm.
Very interesting.
Well, I wonder if being able to alter genetics and create a better child will be sort of the next step in evolution.
Ooh.
If they're paying a lot of money to get people into college. They're
going to
pay a lot of money to make their offspring smarter.
Right.
Well, there's a recent snafu with a Chinese doctor
right.
who had
right.
created.
Did he eliminate something?
He eliminated a trait within in utero twins, I think it was.
Right.
For, I think, was it HIV?
Yep.
Yeah, strangely enough, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what he was trying to eliminate susceptibility to. I don't know, but it had something to do with HIV.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are there any other questions for our speakers? If not, thank you very much for
thank you
studying this book and presenting us.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
It was fun.
It was good for our brains.
What was the thing that you appreciated most about this book?
I think his the archaeological part. You know, he really went into depth about different developments in prehistory.
Okay.
And I just liked, as I said, the basic assumption that gods are created by us. I'm trying to figure out, trying to explain how that happened.
Okay.
Oh, that's true.
Well, we did. But I mean, it's nice to see it in book form.
Yeah.